This is Two Dope Boys and a podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from The Margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. That's right, not written. Phil, go screw yourself. But it's great to see you as always, my brother, my comrade, my paisan. Hey, how you doing?
I'm a believer in the written word, and I'm doing great.
I'm a believer in my beautiful memory. I'm also a believer in Wozni Lambre.
Core crew
from
Yeah,
True
yeah,
Hoop.
Yo. Chia. That's a Jay-Z reference for those of you that weren't there. That weren't here for the pre-show.
Yeah.
Y'all not gonna get that inside joke.
It's okay. But they can know the truth. And the truth is that Two Dope Boys is a critically acclaimed show. Now, it's critically acclaimed because of all of you. Our numbers are growing. The Two Dope Boys militia is growing. All of the creative strategists, friends of the show, thinkers, inquirers, everybody that's listening to and interacting with us online and in person, we appreciate all of it. And just this past week, we got a shout out from Michael Shine in Inc. magazine naming Two Dope Boys one of the top 10 best business podcasts that you should be listening to if you aren't already.
That's how we do. Big shout out for that.
So thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate the recognition. Michael Shine's an interesting dude. Hopefully, actually, we'll be talking with him at some point in the not-too-distant future. But really, really appreciate that recognition in Inc. There's a link to it in the show notes. And it's a great validation because we know with certitude that at least for now, we are not committing any of what we're about to do, which is the brand F-up of the week. Let's get to it, gentlemen.
We stay clear.
Let's get to it, gentlemen. Okay. So a couple of weeks ago, the United Nations missed a pretty significant historical opportunity to appoint its first woman head of the United Nations. Instead, they actually went with a Portuguese gentleman named Antonio Gutierrez, who seems like a very credible pick. But again, everybody was expecting that this would be the first woman head of the UN. Obviously, it's crazy that there hasn't been a head of the UN that's a woman since its inception. And also, just as a brief historical note, there's a kind of particular irony to it, given Eleanor Roosevelt's role in founding and kind of forming the UN. Now, on the heels of that, which we're going to have some brand discussion of in just a second, the UN has just named Wonder Woman as an honorary ambassador, and a lot of people are not happy about that. In fact, there's even a petition to rescind the Wonder Woman ambassadorship. Now, we'll get to the Wonder Woman piece. There's a little bit to pick apart here. But the basic symmetry of the F-up is pass on the first woman head of the UN, but give you a cartoon character with big breasts as a consolation. It's not a good look for a progressive global institution. More to tease out, but that's the basic frame. What do you fellas think?
You know, this story, originally I wasn't, like, the physical optics of the character, which was highlighted, was less important to me than the branding of this. You know, you have an organization that had an opportunity to likely pick someone that was at least credentialed and qualified in their field to be the new Secretary General. And despite all the development work and important political work that the UN does do, they are a branding organization. You know, They are an organization that does carry the torch for a lot of progressive causes, one of those causes being women empowerment. This is something that has been on their list of goals for many years, at least the better half of this decade,
Psych.
If not longer. Yeah.
Right.
And then here we are. You know, this is the best gesture that they can make. I think it falls short of their branding goals, if not their political goals.
Initially, you know, my first thought was this is a weird olive branch if that's what they were trying to do. Right? Like, it came off as kind of
hey, ladies, what the fuck is the problem? Next time, maybe get a broad UN Secretary General in the future, but meanwhile, you can fuck a Wonder Woman. I love how UN diplomats become like Sopranos guys in my routine.
They're all Paulie Walnuts.
But it sounds, I don't understand. Wonder Woman's a very powerful broad.
So, you know, that's where I was at initially with it. You know, when you think of the UN, you think of this progressive organization.
Progressive-ish. Big on the ish.
You know, that's what they try to brand themselves as Phil mentioned earlier. So for them to, you know, be on the heels of skipping over their first female, you know, candidate basically, and then doubly mess that up and come out with this Wonder Woman sort of, I guess this was even a branding effort.
Definitely a branding effort.
It just seemed kind of odd. I don't really know what the UN's policy is on transparency and how they come about these decisions. So, you know, I'd obviously have to do a little bit more research on that. But I was struck by the backlash to the Wonder Woman stuff, because honestly, we're in this like feminist moment, this progressive moment, this
Matt, stop booing. Booing off mic.
We're just hyper aware of these kinds of things nowadays, and I find myself wrestling with a lot of different thoughts, because honestly, I kind of view myself as a feminist in many ways. I do. So, you know,
I think we all do, actually.
A part of me when I see these issues come up, it speaks to the central question, which is, what does that even mean, right, to be a feminist, right? Like, at the end of the day, what does it mean to say this isn't good enough when you portray a woman with big breasts, a white woman, scantily clad? You know, what are we saying when we say that nowadays? That's the kind of things that I grappled with. I wasn't really the UN's sort of fuck up as far as filling this leadership void. That didn't really speak to me as much because I don't know their processes, right?
Right.
It's not like an institution like, say, I don't know, the NFL Players Association, right? Or the commissioner's office in a sports league where it's like, how many white dudes are we going to have?
Well, hopefully a lot.
I'm not as familiar with their processes as I am with those kinds of institutions.
Yeah, I mean, look, the only two addendum comments that I'll make is we kind of brought, I mean, I think the basic brand F-up is clear. It's an F-up that you need to have a UN, a woman secretary general. I mean, that's just reality. And the symmetry of that with the Wonder Woman thing is kind of comical. It's an F-up. Two quick things, though, that annoy me in this process. One is I saw, you know, there was some coverage when the pick initially happened, which didn't get into the intricacies of the actual selection process. Now, there definitely were woman candidates in the rotation from Eastern Europe because it was Europe's turn that definitely were viable, and it's bizarre they weren't picked. That's actually something I wanted to look into more. But I think that some people writing about it in the U.S. press only wrote about it as purely a representation issue, and they didn't take it in any way seriously, the actual job role itself. And I would have liked to have seen more sort of detailed investigation and discovery of the process in some of that writing. Number two, I think in some ways this whole situation distills so much right now, which is that there's all these social media outrages about, you know, about representation and signifiers. Some of them are really important, some of them are debatable, some of them are ludicrous, but I think it's usually on the heels of feeling powerless to influence really big things. And like, the irony to me is like, it's kind of a perfect example. Like, the anger that is justified is, how the fuck do you still not have a woman head of the UN? And then it gets translated into this thing about, you know, Wonder Woman. And the thing is like, you know, Wonder Woman is negotiable, but apparently really accessing and equalizing power isn't. And that's a big problem. That's the brand F of, we got to get to what's up.
All right, now we want to get to what's up. And our what's up is on a sad note.
Yeah.
Because we're giving a RIP to Vine. You know, by the time most of you hear this, Vine would have been shut down for 2 weeks now. We're a 1 week anniversary to the death of Vine, and the internet was in an uproar. about the loss of this social media platform, which admittedly I did not use. So I can't speak to it as someone who was an active Vine user or watcher.
You use Vine? Did you use Vine personally?
I don't use it on a daily basis, but I do like Vic Berger and Todd Dracula, who did really good election coverage. Yeah, there's some really funny stuff on there, like the weirder parts of Vine.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, Vine has been a platform that hit the world by storm. It was acquired by Twitter. For those who are not familiar, it was your ability to record very quick 6-second videos and launched a million social media influencer careers. And now Vine is dead because it's had a lot of competition from Instagram Live, from Snapchat, that probably do what Vine did better with more reach, and Twitter having a host of issues decided to shutter this. And one of the things that immediately jumped to mind is that there are just fewer and fewer players out there. Mm. You know, this is a conversation we've had before around like gate crashers and gatekeepers. Vine was one of those things that was a gate crasher, yep. New to the game, kind of ushered in a new technology, was acquired by what some would argue is a gatekeeper, Twitter being a little bit more mature in their business. And now a year later, they're gone. You know, so I think there's a slightly bigger conversation to be had using Vine as sort of a metaphor for this, what seems to be a closing of the doors to newer and newer platforms. You know, it seems like we're consolidating in our technology spaces and our social media spaces. And the outreach that we saw from the internet has been because Vine was a resource for people who felt that they didn't have a voice. And now that voice is gone. You know, so where does that leave us in this landscape of fewer and fewer options for people to be expressive and participatory in a social media environment?
When I first got the news about Vine, obviously I was a little, I don't want to say sad, but it was for me, it was like this was such a fun new thing when it came out. I think it peaked about 2 years ago, 2014, and it was for a variety of reasons. It was there was a lot of great comedy on there, like the funniest people that you could find on the internet were all over Vine. And what I thought was great about Vine, which is ironic that they were bought by, well, I guess not ironic, it's kind of synergistic more than anything, is that it cut out all the fat because it was 6-second clips. We had YouTube stars before where you could make, you know, you could do all kinds of whatever you wanted to do on YouTube, but those were more long form, especially when you consider Vine was only a 6-second clip in YouTube. You can go up to 5, 10, 15, whatever you wanted. There was, you know, minimal fat, and it just ushered in something that you never thought that you wanted. That's what I think about when I think about gatekeepers. It's given something that you didn't even know you had an appetite for, which is 6-second clips. Another thing that came to mind was, as Phil kind of hinted at when he talked about this moment that we're in with technology and these social media companies, is that, you know, Vine, it comes out, it becomes this big thing. Then Instagram is like, we're going to do videos now, right? We're going to do 15 seconds. We're going to do 30 seconds. We're going to do whatever. And Instagram is a company under Facebook. You understand? And it's like everything now, you know, there's not a lot of, well, there is a lot of creativity, but I think the business model with these bigger companies, whether it be Facebook or Twitter or, you know, whatever it may be, is to, oh, they're doing something really cool and new. Let's figure out how to copy it and just kind of eat them up with our bigger market share. And it's kind of sad in a way, but that's, you know, capitalism in a nutshell. You know, you come out with a new idea, a bigger company's going to now take it and expand upon it. And it's just weird how, you know, Instagram came out with this really cool thing. Facebook said, we're going to buy that. And then with that, we're just going to steal other people's ideas. And it's kind of, you know, I don't know what the way forward is in the future as far as these tech companies, because we look at tech companies as at the forefront of innovation. That's the brand. That's how they brand themselves anyway. But at the end of the day, when billions of dollars are on the line, fuck innovation.
Right? Yeah.
I wonder,
that quote needs to be spread far and wide because that's the reality. I mean, I think I don't know. You guys both hit on so many essential points. I'm going to loop back to both of them, but I just want to read a little bit from the article just for some kind of qualitative data points on this conversation. This is why did people love Vine? And this is a Katie Rogers reported piece in the New York Times. Basically, she says, and I'm quoting now, Vines turned nonsense into short bursts of hilarious art. Vine also had real utility for sports fans who used it to replay memorable moments from the arena and on the field over and over again. And skipping forward, DeRay McKesson, civil rights activist, was one of several people who pointed out that Vine gave protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, a way to broadcast what was happening the months following the shooting death of Michael Brown. So you see the tracks there from humor, comedy, entertainment, hilarity to sports experience and interface to modern civil rights movements. Vine played a lot of functions. I think, you know, the really key question here comes to like the operating systems of capitalism. This is a very Douglas Rushkoff conversation, and I'd encourage everybody who's new to the show to go back in our archives and listen to our On Point interview with the really, you know, sort of genuinely brilliant Douglas Rushkoff, because, you know, the reality is that as long as the operating system of capitalism is heading towards monopolies, and as long as the incentive structure is you either are attempting to create a monopoly, which now is very hard in the tech space, so more likely what you're trying to do is launch a credible startup and get absorbed by one of the pre-existing large platforms, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and so on, that is going to stifle exactly what you said, Waz, which is innovation, right? So that the whole brand of an industry, which is built on this notion that it's disclosing and creating new worlds, is actually locked in some very, very old frameworks. And this notion that the operating system of the tech is completely open and can be hacked and can be innovated, but the operating system of how we design businesses, how we design ownership structures
is old
and locked into place in a closed proprietary system is a major problem. And then you're going to still see this dynamic. And I mean, we've talked about this before. Part of the reason that Vine shut is Twitter had to shut it because Twitter's hemorrhaging. Well, you know, Twitter, and again, this goes back to the Douglas Rushkoff conversation. The reality with Twitter is that the reason Twitter is having problems is because it followed a model of having an IPO. It followed a model of becoming this, you know, public tech company.
Right.
Right. Now, the reality is that from another perspective, if you weren't pursuing that path, you might say to yourself, wow, this platform employs a couple hundred people. It basically is just public text messaging. It creates about $1 billion in revenue a year, and it creates an unbelievable amount of social value for all the problems of Twitter. Yeah. Now, that's a success. And the only reason that becomes not a success is because it is filtered through systems.
The lens of shareholders.
The lens of shareholders. And that is not compatible with the next stages of capitalism and innovation we're talking about. So if you want to synchronize the rhetoric of innovation, then everything needs to be on the table, not just the tech. The ownership structure needs to be on the table. The investor structure needs to be on the table. And that's why, you know, companies like Patagonia are in some ways, even though they're sort of analog and outdoor clothing, they're pointing the way much more fully towards a business model that synchronizes with this tech future than a lot of these tech companies.
Yeah, and your expectations have to go in that direction as well. Right. Like, you have to realize that you're not going to be everything to everybody. You have to be comfortable with that. And when Twitter first launched, you know, we'll kind of use them as a good example because they were the ones who bought Vine.
Right.
You know, and subsequently shuttered it. You know, one of the more interesting things about Twitter, if you're in that kind of early stage Twitter, like 2009-10, those kind of years, one of their big advantages was that their architecture was an open architecture.
Right.
So people were able to sort of create their own platforms to which you can access Twitter. You know, TweetDeck right. was one of those early innovators.
And which they ended up buying.
Yeah, which they ended up buying.
And, that's the problem.
And once they got closer to that model, that IPO model, they closed the architecture. You know, that was one of the first things they did that sort of raised eyebrows in their community, because I think many people felt you know, in those early days, like Twitter was kind of this community, this sort of
open source.
Yeah, open source way for people to communicate and kind of get unfiltered news and events and what have you.
That is the spirit that created all this shit.
Yeah. Right.
We wouldn't
Why
have
would you abandon that?
Any yeah. of this shit to fuck around with. We created all of these technologies that created commons and open platforms, and we've decided that the best thing to do with them is just throw them into a shareholder model and create an incredibly traditional structure that makes it profitable for a couple people. And guess what? The flip side of it is it's not even going to work on the other side, because these jobs are these companies are never going to generate that many jobs.
And they're not built for that.
They're not built for that. You have the worst of both worlds. You don't even have the industrial model of, like, maybe the profits are lopsided, maybe the structure is old and archaic. But if you're building fucking cars or wind turbines or whatever, at least you'll employ a lot of people.
Right.
You ain't going to employ a lot of
that. Yeah, they just got servers and programs. If we're simplifying it, but it, you know, they're never going to have 30,000 people working for them.
No.
They're not
going
to
Twitter?
Have yeah.
Hell no.
Or
no.
Facebook or any of these, Instagram or any of these people.
No, I mean,
or Apple.
No, yeah. Apple's the perfect
example. Or if they start paying people to look after harassment and abuse, but I don't think any companies are going to do any of that.
Hey now.
You know what? But even if you
but that's the flip. That's the flip. One thing they haven't policed.
Right. That's the one thing they haven't
that
policed.
That they probably should have.
Also, for what it's worth, that ain't going to, that's not 30,000 people.
Right. No, it's not.
So you know what I mean?
People,
Google does have people that they employ. I actually know a friend of mine's fiance actually does that for Google. She fucking looks at videos all day of things that might get flagged. They have psychotherapists on staff. It's one of the most disturbing, horrifying jobs I've ever heard about in my life.
Well,
from flagging potential.
Somebody's got to do it.
I mean,
you
God.
You ever seen that
damn,
show, Dirty Jobs?
Yo, this is
digital.
That makes Dirty Jobs looks like you're managing the Mandarin Oriental, dude. At least psychologically.
Right.
I mean, it's not actually a dirty job, but it's a fucking.
You're not scraping the roadkill off the highway, but it's mental roadkill.
Yeah.
That's gross.
Mental beyond roadkill, man.
Yeah.
I want to circle back to something Michael mentioned about Twitter, how it's grown, and, you know, now it's basically, it's a social, it's a utility.
It's a utility, right?
You know, like, this is the conduit. Well, I guess Facebook is creeping in on them, but this is the conduit through which news gets out there.
Yeah.
Right.
No matter what. And, you know, the thing I still like about Twitter is that it is still a place to exchange ideas. You know, and
fuck you.
Even if that idea is just fuck you, you know, it is still
you
one
fucking
of
black immigrant. You don't like Trump. You want to kill this country. Fuck it's, you.
It's one of the
Mega.
Few places.
Major,
it's the, one of the few places where I'll ever come in contact with or talk to a Republican in any meaningful way.
Fuck you.
Except
I'm sorry.
Except for producer Matt.
besides.
Besides that,
when Waz gets in, I just gotta take like the periodic, once every couple of episodes, to say that no, Matt does not break up with girls over text message. No, he's not a Republican. No, he's not a racist. He's really actually a very enlightened man.
He's the sweetest guy that you'll ever fucking meet. Yes. But
his only entertainment,
right? Shouts to Jay. That's a call back to the pre-show again.
That's the pre-show. For those who know,
that's actually Matt's favorite Jay-Z song.
Oh man. But yeah, Twitter has gotten to this place where it is a social utility, right? It is something we all use to gather news. It's how, like, that's literally how I get my news. I've curated my timeline to make sure I get all the smartest people in sports, politics, science, medicine, just not music, because you motherfuckers don't know shit about music. Let me tell you something. No, sorry. That was just a side rant. I didn't mean to do that. But no, and I say all of that to say that Vine, you know, what is so cool, and I've talked about Atlanta on this show. You guys even had an Atlanta episode. Mm-hmm. That kid, I'm sorry, his name escapes me right now, from the public access show where the guy was, you know, he was born the wrong race. That kid with the dreads.
Okay, yeah.
The transracial
guy. Yeah, the
guy,
transracial
right?
episode. Yeah.
The transracial guy. He's been on YouTube forever, right? My cousin Nod, shouts to Nod, he put me onto that dude's videos two summers ago. And he was like, this is some of the only shit that I watch because, you know, we don't got a lot of black people on TV. And this guy is hilarious, right? Vine was sort of a breeding ground for that. So I just, right. you know, I just want to say just a public service announcement to brands, to companies, to people with money, with means, with opportunity. These are the places where these people are congregating. The young creatives, the young hungry people of America, of the world, realistically. And, you know, when we're losing these kind of platforms, and although they are smaller, something like Vine is a lot smaller than Twitter and, of course, Facebook, you know, these are where the young innovators go to congregate.
It's where
they're the early adapters. They're the ones that go to these places and make them what they are.
Yeah, experiment.
You know, so
it's where culture simmers. That's what we right. talk about with the prime directive, the cultural prime directive. And that point is, and this is where brands are fucking themselves and where you need our help. Because
Ding!
You are exactly because you are lit through these design structures. You're choking off the opportunity of the culture that you need to incubate and develop to yes. create a platform to generate the content that you need to sell your fucking products. So it's a virtuous circle if you let it be.
Yo, oh, sorry. Quick, actually, real addendum on the on the Vine story. Sorry, I meant to say this.
You just not gonna let us stop.
No. Sorry, yeah. sorry. I meant to say yeah. this before. The GIF search engine Giphy, they raised $75 million, and they're gonna basically build a platform that you could house your Vines.
Oh, word.
So they stepped up to the plate in order for Vine not to just, you know, die a sad, tragic death.
That's what's up.
Well, goddamn.
All right, so now we got to get to what's next. I think we're going to have some new segments soon, like the digression, the argument, the conflict, the addendum, the race
the
war.
The addendum to the addendum.
Matt. No, I'm just playing. So today on Twitter, the day we're recording this, you'll hear this a week later, obviously, but Bill Fletcher Jr., who's a political commentator, activist, analyst, who I admire a lot, I've interviewed, he posted a story. I think it was from research based, I think from the University of Massachusetts, that showed that Uber drivers, if you're black and using Uber, twice as likely that a driver will cancel on you if they know that you're black. And I subtweeted him. I retweeted it. I subtweeted and I wrote, same new world, same as the old. And in that vein, Facebook is letting advertisers exclude users by race. And I'm going to quote now from an investigative piece from ProPublica that sort of gets to the heart of this story. Quote, if you imagine if during the Jim Crow era, a newspaper offered advertisers the option of placing ads only in copies that went to white readers. That's exactly what Facebook is doing nowadays. The ubiquitous social network is not only allowing advertisers to target users by their interests and backgrounds, it's also giving advertisers the ability to exclude specific groups it calls quote-unquote ethnic affinities, ads that exclude people based on race, gender, and other sensitive factors are inhibited by federal law in housing and employment. And there's a screenshot in the article showing basically how easy it is for corporations to make these selections. Now, I've had to fight off a lot of selection suggestions from both Phil and Matt as we've built this
damn
show.
Election affinity. Or what is it?
ethnic affinity.
Damn ethnic affinity. You gave yourself away there as an actual.
Stop eating cornbread, Matt, for once. Jesus. How else are you going to get a house?
So look, I think what's fascinating about this, three things, and we'll get to the specific sort of disgustingness. And we've held this for a what's next, not a brand F up, because this, you know, raises, I mean, brand F-ups raise important issues, but this raises very important fundamental issues. But look, number one, again, this is a platform issue. That's a theme of this show and a theme of Two Dope Boys in general. When you have such a concentration of platforms in the information social network economy, decisions like this play an incredibly disproportionate role in our lives. And Facebook, we already know, filters information, it filters networks, it filters a lot of things which are very dangerous given its sort of information delivery capacity. And now we know it's offering corporations and advertisers the option of racial limitations. So that's a profoundly dangerous consequence of the concentration of platform. And then number two loops back to the Uber point. Nothing new under the sun. Even in the innovation economy, if we don't redesign the operating systems of our attitudes, our institutions, our empathy, and really overcome the sort of founding poison of this country, we are not going to be able to make actual progress, never mind the sort of particular this or that innovation. This story is disturbing, it's important, and thirdly, it shows a failure of leadership. Phil and I talk about this a lot. A couple of months ago, Mark Zuckerberg actually released a very thoughtful statement on Black Lives Matter, but we pointed out at the time and talked about this amongst ourselves that even though this was a smart and sensitive statement, it was a responsive statement. It wasn't proactive. It wasn't leadership driven. And we can see this consequence right here in the fact that this is even a functionality that's available. It's a failure of real leadership in any 21st century economy, any 21st century company.
I'm probably going to take a slightly different tack on it. When I read the story, it didn't really surprise me, but I think there's a couple of dangers that are built into some of our preconceived notions around technology and data. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that technology and data platforms are often used as a sort of a panacea. I think we've seen that as part of the branding of Silicon Valley and tech culture, that whatever problem exists, we can find a tech-based solution to it.
Which we cannot.
I think most people would say we can't, but one can always make the argument that we've seen an incredible explosion of apps and technologies that in some way do simplify our life, but then open up a bunch of unintended consequences. Right. And I think this Facebook portion of their marketing platform is one of those unintended consequences, in the sense that I don't think their design team built this to be used in this way.
Right.
But bias, you know, it's kind of like Jurassic Park, nature will find a way. Racism and cultural insensitivity and bias
will
find a way to use these platforms in the way in which they were not initially intended.
Just to clarify, like, so an innocuous version of this might be like, I'm trying to think of the most, like, if you're offering a product or service that is literally geared to a very specific market, it's okay to select for that type of thing. If you're like, well, this is for, you know, I don't know, like women of a certain age or men of a certain age, that's not necessarily discriminatory.
They test, like, if you wanted to test an advertisement in English, mm-hmm, to reach a primarily Latino audience,
right,
and also test the same ad in Spanish,
right,
with that same audience, you want to be able to self-select that those in a particular group that might have an affinity toward that language will get it. Non-Latino, non-Spanish speaker, if you're just doing a test, it wouldn't make sense for me to get that ad.
And that's the thought behind this.
And that's the thought. I think that leads us down a couple of different avenues. One, that there are unintended consequences to technology and data uses. And when you have the people within these communities, tech culture has had well-documented issues with not being diverse. Mm-hmm. And when you factor in that the people at these platforms, whether it's Facebook or any other, probably come from fairly homogeneous communities, if not ethnically, at least in mindset,
right,
meaning that they're sort of dealing with what's popularly known as first world problems,
right,
in the first place,
lack of cognitive diversity.
Yeah, you're going to have people who are not thinking about the full breadth of the implications of some of these things. They roll them out to answer the questions or to serve needs of brand partners, marketers, what have you, without thinking about like, oh, this can also be used in ways that are not that cool. Like I remember years ago when Uber was kind of in their early stages, contrary to this new study, one of the ways they branded Uber was that it was going to take the racism out of people being able to catch cabs in places
like New York. No Brooklyn.
Yeah.
No Brooklyn.
You were no longer going to hear that.
Right.
That was part of their branding, at least in New York City.
A couple months ago, we were in the Lower East Side out like partying late, and we were catching a yellow cab to get back to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And it was funny, man, because you were flagging it, and you thought the dude blew by us. But he actually stopped. You looked at me and you're like, you should probably get this cab for us.
Yeah,
cab, and you were like, wait a second.
Do the job.
That dude actually stopped.
You know, yeah.
We jumped
next
in
door.
We caught it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like next door is another example of that. Like San Francisco app, based out of San Francisco, but I think is in more cities now. You know, they initially started off as sort of like a digital neighborhood watch.
Right.
That was then co-opted by people reporting their neighbors just because they were people of color.
Right.
You know, like an unintended consequence of a platform that wasn't designed for that. So I think as we look into the future, there's different ways in which we want to tackle this reliance on technology and data.
It's brilliant. Absolutely.
A couple of things. When I first read this, the first thing that came to mind, I was like, if you're trying to advertise to only white people, isn't that what the people who sell ads to, I don't know, the Big Bang Theory, isn't that what they're already doing? No, but that's what came to my mind.
You know, right? I'm really proud of myself, but I don't know what the Big Bang Theory is.
Oh God, it's a show that
I guess not very many minorities watch.
It is fantastic.
It's the most popular sitcom in America.
Yeah,
I guess so, I'm doing pretty well then.
Yeah, so that's all you need to know about that. And, yeah, I happen to not know anybody who watches it, so you need to think about who's actually watching it. They don't live in New York, Miami, L.A., Chicago, D.C.,
classic CBS, American.
I fucking love Waz's just unapologetic, like, coastal elitism. It's beautiful.
You know, think
about it, because you were in Chicago, you were... Pretty much, you're inbred.
You know why? That's just a pushback for me from when I consume media.
But much
media.
Love to all Americans.
I never hear any, like, what's the, you know when they say earnest Midwesterners or salt of the earth? There's no terms like that to describe city people.
No.
And I feel a way about that. And
city
that's
people
why,
are assholes.
And that's why in every single public platform that I'm on, I take it, you know, upon myself to point out the flaws in those people.
I can attest as someone who is connected with Waz on all social platforms imaginable, that's very true.
Yeah, so that was the first thing I thought. Obviously that was a joke. But, you know, we're living in a data-driven moment as well. And I think that the people that are more geared towards data, people that see themselves as data-driven people, they tend to think of data as unemotional, right? And that's why they like it. It's not driven by bias. It's not driven by, you know, perception,
truth.
Right?
They love to say that.
They
it
think
tells
that,
the truth.
They
the
think there's an
truth.
Inherent truth in this in data. But at the end of the day, the only truth is in the sort of determinations that you're able to make from that data.
That's right.
Right? So you guys had that woman, Kathy O'Neill,
on the Majority Report. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Brilliant book.
She was amazing.
Weapons of Math Destruction. Everybody, this is an early crates. Everybody peep that book. It's brilliant.
And what she pointed out, she talked about these algorithms that people use for different processes. And she was like, these algorithms are only as good as the data that you choose to incentivize.
That's right.
So you can have data, but it's just data.
Right.
There might be a lot of noise in that data.
Right.
You know, you might be not be accounting for the people that are misrepresented. It's just like there's so many things around just data in and of itself. And I think that the problem with a lot of tech companies and in the tech world, you know, a lot of data-driven people tend to think that data is everything. And if you don't interrogate this data if you don't look at it as far as, you know, you need to question this stuff, right? You need to question, like, just, well, why do I only want white people or black
people?
Well,
they're trying to get, how should I say, clean data.
Right, right. But, and also, you know, as far as in any company, it's not just, and, you know, obviously Facebook is the first stop on this train.
Right.
But even the realtor or the, you know,
very much
or
so.
The loan officer. Yes. What about the social contract?
Yes, yes.
You know, what's your responsibility to the community that you, you know, ostensibly are supposed to be serving? And I think a lot of people that are in the data industry, they tend to poo-poo that kind of stuff. And that's what it, you know, that's what it boils down to. All of this stuff, you know, all of this data, you know, my cousin Nar shouts him. This is the second time I'm shouting him. You know, he has this saying.
He's good today.
Yeah, he has this.
Yeah, he is. He's a good dude.
He has this saying. He has this saying where he says, how are you ignorant in the information age? Right? But it's like, how.
No, I have a counter saying, which is, how are you not ignorant in the information
age? Because it's a lot.
Because it's a lot, right?
You understand what I'm saying? You have all of this data, and again, it's only as good as, you know, the determinations that you're able to make behind that. Somebody like Facebook, again, this is the type of company that, whether it be people like you guys with your own podcast, just the users themselves, which I think is a, you know, one of the components of tech that I do like. They're very responsive to their user base,
right?
You know, it's not like, say, Barack Obama, if I write this guy, a trillion people write him.
Hey, Waz, that's a great, go fuck yourself.
Exactly.
That's a great, wow, I really appreciate your thoughts on, suck my neck.
They're very responsible to their user base. They feel a responsibility to the community of users to a certain extent, which is larger than, you know, a lot of these bigger
institutions. Hey, Waz, do you have any thoughts on the Toronto Raptors starting lineup? Because it's interesting because, I don't give a fuck.
Exactly. And yeah, I think that's, you know, in the future, obviously a company like Facebook, they're going to have to be more mindful because it's going to be bad business not to.
That's exactly right. You know, that's what we always say. And I mean, look, I think that's everything you said is so important, both of you, but just this notion that culture globally, nationally and globally is filtered through certain city centers historically, right? New York is obviously a cultural sort of center. London, you know, I mean, these places where sort of culture moves from. You know, right now, San Francisco, Silicon Valley is a cultural center that doesn't even recognize that it's a cultural center. And that's a big problem.
Nerd alert.
Nerd alert is a big problem. People think that nerdism can solve problems, and it won't. It's a deceptive, simple answer to very complex challenges. And when you have a situation where people don't even understand that their baseline assumptions are not in play because they think the baseline is just the truth, you're going to miss out on all of the subtleties that we're talking about. And this is where in one another data point that I want to argue, there's this dude, Ken Wilber, that I know I've probably mentioned before, maybe not, but I think I have, who has this quadrant system where he talks about internal and external, objective and subjective realities, right? And that basically you can sort of filter all of these ways of looking at and understanding the world through these different types of metrics, and people migrate to different places. Some people just want to look at like collective narratives explaining how the world works. Some people just want to look at the numbers explaining how the world works. The reality is that both are important, and you're not going to get a full picture without
an integration.
Both, without an integration. And the problem is we have an incredible amount of capital, literally, and an incredible amount of intellectual effort and in business of trying to just reduce it all to the data. And it's a problem for culture, and it's a big problem for business, because at the very moment that more and more people are claiming their voices on these platforms and the world is getting more and more complex and more contested, which is a good thing, this hunt and this hunger and this desire to reduce it down to simple algorithms is the sort of trend of the day in the tech culture, which is fine as a tool, but it's not fine as a philosophical view.
All these organizations, they have value systems, you know? Exactly. And I think as Facebook kind of goes from a plucky startup to now a global monolith,
right?
It's a news organization. It's a data organization. It's all of these things in one in one embodiment, and you look at, you know, where they align themselves. You know, they've had issues with the founder of Oculus. You know, they acquired Oculus, and their founder has been accused of funding these sort of alternative right, meme machines.
Trump memes.
Yeah, he's, you know, Peter Thiel is a well publicized Trump guy, and also more disturbingly, you know, help fund the eventual bankruptcy of Gawker. You know, like,
yeah,
they're
as a dude who has, you know, I think of, yeah,
they
absolutely.
they have outsized
anti-democratic tendencies.
They have an outsized influence on how we're shaping narratives, and you know, that's tangentially connected to business, like, you know, subsets of this sort of business, you know, where they're just doing whatever it is they want to do,
and
with
it's a
very
social
little
and political problem, but it's a business problem.
Yeah,
because you're opening up these platforms. Like, who makes these platforms? Is everybody?
But more importantly, Michael, who's drawing the lines?
The drawing the lines is this incredibly narrow subset of this nerdist
ethically,
culture.
Ethically, yeah. Where are you with target marketing in and of itself?
Right.
This idea that I'm going to single you out because of this information that I purchased from a company, and I'm going to fucking manipulate your ass.
You know what's
right
so
now?
Funny? I just have to say as a brief anecdote. I was out on a date with a woman once who worked in some type
Wait,
of...
Wait, Michael, you date women?
Whoa! Look at you!
Kidding,
that's what I've been trying to
kidding,
tell you when you holler at me
kidding,
all the time, but you
kidding,
don't listen.
Kidding. Me and Michael yeah. not have sex. Don't spread that.
Well, no, I don't have sex with him, but he harasses the fuck out of me. But look, but the thing is that she said to me, she explained to me, she worked in some type of micro advertising firm, and she explained to me all the metrics that they accumulate to target people. And I was like, well, you know, that actually sounds to me exactly the way a signature drone strike is designed.
Hell yeah.
And she was all offended. I was like, no, this is reality. This is the same metrics that are used. That's what's next. We got to get to the crease.
Now we want to get to the crates. Digging into crates is when we bring you a piece of work that you'll find interesting and might make you smarter, more nimble, and better.
Nimble.
And better.
Whew.
I got two quick.
Nimble is
I'll try
better.
To make them quick, actually. One is a movie that I recently, it's one of these movies that are kind of always on again and off again on cable.
Right.
And I caught it over the course of the weekend, and it just, it always cracks me up because I think it's Undercover Brother.
That's a hysterical movie.
It's a good
it,
movie.
It doesn't really get, I think, the credit.
Matt reminds
that it
me of
should
Dave
get.
Chappelle's Conspiracy Brother.
Conspiracy
in that movie.
Brother.
Yeah, that's what
he's
Matt
the,
reminds
he's
me.
He's the best. He's one of the best characters in the whole movie. Like, I'm not overly an Eddie Griffin fan generally.
Sure.
Like, he's not funny stand up to me, and his whole shtick has never really been funny.
It's a little,
you know, but he nailed it with Undercover Brother. The movie has, it hits all the marks, you know, for, you know, General's Fried Chicken, the songs, Dave Chappelle, Smart Brother, kind of peak Denise Richards. It kind of has all
I
the,
was a big Denise
yeah,
Richards
Yeah, man.
Fan.
Denise
I
Richards
just, I gotta
was
say, like,
at
I just
want
to say, like, if you could see Waz's face right now, that would warrant, like, an iTunes, like, explicit rating in and of itself.
My God.
It's actually uncomfortable. Don't look at me when you make that face.
Yo, you can't General Fried Chicken and peak Denise Richards. You can't go wrong
can't
with
go
any
wrong.
Of those things. So, Undercover Brother, if you haven't seen the movie, definitely check it. It's dope. And the other thing I recommend is I just bit the bullet and got onto Netflix. And
wow,
yeah, I've been
talking about a dinosaur.
Yeah, dude, I was not fucking with Netflix. I was finding alternative means.
I'm talking all that. I'm talking like that. I'm borrowing this pass first.
You really want to put yourself out like that?
I couldn't use alternatives.
That's that real conversation. Like, all right, I know this isn't going to work anymore, baby. But I mean, it's not that bad that I can't use your password anymore, right?
I didn't have no password to scam, so I had to bite the bullet. The show is Robotech, and it's a classic anime, one of the first long form animes that came to the U.S. in the '80s, and really, I would say, launched like large-scale interest in what's now known as anime. And back in the 80s, it was like Japanese animation. People didn't even really know how to get it. But it's a groundbreaking series, 85 episodes, and it's all on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It has like one of the first like interracial relationships that I think I ever saw
was calm down, man.
In this show. So it's a groundbreaking show on a lot of different levels. Characters actually really die. It was not a cartoon for kids. Mm. And it really, I think, brought animation and Japanese animation in particular to like young audiences. And now anime is kind of everywhere. But Robotech, I think, was one of the first series that popularized it. And it's all on Netflix, all 85 episodes.
But is it better than Pokemon?
Everything's Everything's better than Pokemon.
Such a provocateur.
Yeah, my crate is actually an article. It's by a guy named Wesley Morris. He's a cultural critic for the New York Times. It's called The Last Taboo, Why Pop Culture Just Can't Deal with Black Male Sexuality. And it's about, you know, traditionally when you get nudity in movies or TV, for that matter, it's the female anatomy. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a moment right now where you're frankly seeing a lot of dicks.
He said frankly, like. Frankly, you're seeing a lot of dicks.
When you talk,
what happened to America?
No, but when you talk about the male anatomy.
I just have to say real quick, I'm sorry for this diversion. Sure. When this drops, this will be literally Tuesday election day.
Wow.
So fuck.
Shit.
I hope everybody will go out and vote. Okay, go ahead, dicks.
But yeah, no, so you know, you're used to seeing the female anatomy, and there's been a lot of critiques of that, you know, why are we always seeing breasts and bush and this and that? And we never see the male anatomy.
We see everything.
And I think that's kind of, and Wesley addresses that in the article, and that's being addressed right now. But it's only a certain kind of male. It's generally the white guy.
Holla.
Right. And he goes into.
You gotta say that on mic.
You're welcome.
Thank you, man. He goes into why that is. You know, the struggle. He talks about stuff like the white man, for lack of a better term, white man, white woman, white people's obsession with the black anatomy. You know, how black people's sexuality have sort of been portrayed in media traditionally as hyper-aggressive, hypersexual, all these different things. He goes into all of these different things in the article. You know, it's about the black male sexuality. It's about black male stereotypes as far as like, you know, the size of a black guy's penis. He talks about the size of his own penis. He talks about all kinds of things. He gets kind of raw in this thing. It's really freaking good, and I would recommend everybody read it. That's my crate right now.
Dope. Yeah. All right, so now we're gonna have Mr. Sean Awan, Two Dope Boys associate, Two Dope Boys instigator. Yo. He's coming right in.
What's up, everybody? So I'm going to do Sweatshop Boys. They got a new album out. It's called Cashmere. The reason why I like these dudes is because they're two brown dudes, one Indian, one Pakistani, you know, came together. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Riz MC from The Night Of.
Yeah.
And then Himanshu, he used to be in a rap group called Dash Racist. Yep. With Kool AD, Victor Vasquez. Anyways, these two came together, came up with this album. You know, talk about a lot of the parallels between each culture, and then also a lot of the problems and ways to get past all that stuff. So, really cool album, just dropped. You guys should check it out.
Sean Awan coming through. Thanks, man. You'll be hearing a lot more of him soon.
I got a quick crate.
Now we got to get the super producer, Matt Leck.
So,
now I have told you it cannot be the Turner Diaries.
Or Mein Kampf.
Or Mein. I was trying to go subtle with that joke. Watch this goes Mein Kampf.
I'd like to recommend My Struggle by Carlo Vnausgaard. My real crates. Adam Curtis, who's sort of an influence of mine.
I love Adam Curtis, dude.
He's documentarian. You can find a lot of his documentaries on YouTube. Okay. He's got a new one out called Hypernormalization, which goes into Trump. It goes into Gaddafi. It goes into the Assad family, oil, and our intelligence services. A lot of interesting stuff. It's just fantastic. You can find it on YouTube. It's also on the BBC iPlayer if you can get that to work in the States or wherever you're at. So that's my crate.
Adam Curtis is brilliant. Co-sign on everything by that dude. I'll have a crate from him soon, actually. That's a good call.
Yo, right. Matt, email me that link, boy.
And smoke more weed. so, yeah. All right. I'm going to recommend another documentary. I have not seen this, and I've known about it for years, and it's crazy. This past weekend, I guess a week ago when you're hearing this, I had a little bit of time to finally sit down and watch it. It's Pumping Iron. It's made, I think, in the late 70s. It's about the Mr. Universe competition, which took place in South Africa. It highlights a young Arnold Schwarzenegger. This is one of the most bizarre documentaries I've ever seen in my life. The culture of bodybuilding, which I really did not know much about, it's just bizarre. That's really the only word I could use for it. And I would say, like, unlike, you know, sort of other sports cultures where, I mean, it's just, I couldn't wrap my head around it, but it's fascinating. And then you got a young Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's the biggest shark, the biggest hustler. I was texting Phil while I was watching it because I knew Phil liked the documentary and we talked about it before, even though I hadn't seen it. And I was like, blah, 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 this is about bodybuilding, blah, blah, blah. This is about the fact that they're doing this competition in apartheid South Africa. And then blah, blah, blah. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the biggest fucking hustler, shark, genius I have ever seen in my life. And now everything makes sense. Like, of course the dude was going to become governor of California. It's a entertaining, interesting, and it's also a very specific time in American life. It's a very specific time in global life. And whatever you think of it, I mean, we're all about the margins here. And that's a fascinating margin that literally influenced and shaped the rest of culture, because you had this little sideline, but Schwarzenegger was in the sideline. He's going to become a global pop star, a global movie star, and a governor. So Pumping Iron, I want you to check that out. Super producer Matt Leck, thank you as always for your incredible producing ability. Shauna Wan, Two Dope Boys associate, he's doing great things with us. We're working on growing, getting bigger, better, finding new people to link up and partner up with. You can text the tweet us, find us on Instagram at Two Dope Boys Pod. We appreciate all of the support we've been getting. We're going to actually start reading some of your emails, reading some of your tweets. So come at us with your thoughts. We already have an email that we got banked up for next week where my man and collaborator and really, in fact, brother Phil is called a habitual line stepper, which I'm going to actually agree with. But that's just a
great
preview.
Compliment, actually.
It is a great compliment. I want to be a habitual line stepper, too. So, Phil, thank you, man. Thanks for another journey.
Always a good trip.
Always. Waz.
Yo.
Core crew. True Hoops. Find him at Big Waz on Twitter. Thank you so much, man. It's always a good feeling when you're here. We will see you all for Thursday for On Point.